Around the clock, around the world, Bloomberg keeps you connected on television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
I'm Lewis Lapham with The World in Time for July 2nd. My guest is the historian Jeffrey Warrow, speaking with us today about the 100 years of America's pursuit of power in the Middle East. Your new book, Jeff, comes with the title Quicksand, which suggests that the story is not a happy one. Where and why does America first set foot in the desert?
We didn't have much interest in the Middle East at all right up until the First World War. It was generally a European preserve. It was carved into French and British colonies, and then they were converted into mandates. But because of the big American role at the Paris Peace Conference ending World War I and Woodrow Wilson's avowed internationalism, he was determined to try to defang the worst aspects of colonialism and prepare peoples for national self-determination and eventual independence. So Woodrow Wilson really took a strong interest in the Middle East, and he dispatched the King Crane Commission to tour Palestine and asked the inhabitants in very American fashion, what did they want? What kind of a future do they want? What kind of a country do they want? And what he found there was a largely Palestinian country, largely Arab country, with concentrations of Jews. But it was, you know, there were twice as many Palestinian Arabs there at the time as Jews. And so he came back, and the King Crane Commission came back, and Wilson found himself on the horns of a dilemma. Did he support a Jewish state as per the Balfour Declaration of 1917, or did he push for a Palestinian state? Now, there he was lobbied pretty hard by a Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, look, it'll make sense politically to support a Jewish state, and it'd be good politics at home. It would be good politics abroad as well, because it would be a loyal U.S. ally and that sort of thing. So this is the first time we really saw the U.S. taking an interest in the Middle East. And then, of course, our interest picked up as we transitioned from coal to oil, and as we began to observe just how much oil was buried in Middle Eastern wells in the 1920s and 30s.
Before we go to the oil, explain the contradiction between the Balfour Declaration, and tell us what that is, and the policy of self-determination that Wilson comes up with in the 14 points.
Quicksand talks a lot about the Balfour Declaration. It was proposed by the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, who, in the midst of the First World War, he was looking for a way to buck up the Entente, to weaken the Central Powers, Austria-Hungary, largely Austria-Hungary and Germany, by detaching their Jewish populations from their regimes. And also for a way to steal some momentum from the Russian Revolution. Many of the Bolsheviks were Jews, and so Balfour thought, well, if I concede a Jewish state in Palestine, this will then earn the goodwill of the Bolsheviks and might keep them in the war on our side. And then, of course, Arthur Balfour wanted to create a Jewish state in Palestine because he thought a community of European Jews that would be moved to the Middle East would be grateful to Great Britain, would be reliant upon Great Britain for their protection. They could be armed by Great Britain. They'd be like a strong shoulder on the edge of the Suez Canal, which was the major lifeline of the British Empire. So it was from this mix of motives, some noble, most of them, you know, imperialistic and ignoble, that the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, came up with this so-called Balfour Declaration. He was always quite conflicted about it because he was, at the same time, Britain was an imperial power overseeing diverse populations. It was one of the largest groups in the British Empire, obviously, were Muslims when you think about the subcontinent, but also the Middle East. He was very conflicted because he knew that if he created a Jewish state in Arab Palestine, that this would inflame Muslim opinion all across the Middle East and South Asia. So that's how he came up with the idea of a Balfour Declaration. As Quicksand makes clear, Chaim Weizmann, who was in London advising Balfour, lobbying Balfour, pressing Balfour, always was very careful to say, look, we're not asking for a Jewish state, really. We're asking for a Jewish commonwealth. We're not going to go in there and colonize the Palestinians. We're going to share with the Palestinians. They are going to profit from our development of the region. And Balfour, obviously distracted by all the demands of World War I on so many fronts, never really questioned Weizmann too closely. And then once this Jewish agency under Chaim Weizmann was stood up, it developed a great momentum of its own that pushed ahead, formed the Knesset Israel, schools, a parliament, universities in the Holy Land, and they quickly outclassed and overshadowed the majority Arab population by their energy, by their determination, by their zeal. And then before long, Balfour and then his successors in the 20s and 30s and 40s were dealing with a very assertive, self-confident, proto-Jewish state that basically did as it wanted. And if the British tried to push them back, limit Jewish immigration, they would get around it by having illegal immigration coming in on illegal boats and that sort of thing. And so the British found themselves having created the Jewish state via the Balfour Declaration. By the late 30s and the 1940s, they were pressing back hard against it, trying to maintain a balance between the roughly 600,000 Jews of Palestine and the 1.3 million Arabs.
You also say that Nazi Germany and Russia, with their racist attitudes, have a great deal to do with the inrush of immigration of Jews into Palestine in the late 30s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things Quicksand makes clear is there might never have been a state of Israel had it not been for the racist policies of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust itself, which created such a humanitarian crisis that it released this flow of Jewish displaced persons after the war. And then during the war, there was, you know, in the 30s and then right up until World War II, there was a constant pressure for Jews to escape not only Nazi Germany, but other anti-Semitic regimes in Poland, Hungary, Romania, and try to get to the Holy Land. In a way, they were channeled toward the Holy Land because they were kept out of places like the United States, Australia, South Africa by, I think anti-Semitic is too strong a term, but immigration quotas in the U.S., in South Africa, in Australia, in even places like Argentina that really limited the amount of Jews that could come out of East Central Europe to these countries.
We're talking about America's pursuit of power. So get to the election of 1948, Truman and the setting up of the Jewish state. I mean, that begins to bring us into the politics of the Middle East.
In a way, the Jews had nowhere to go but Palestine because of anti-Jewish immigration quotas in the most natural refuges for them. And so, well, what happened was between the 1880s and the 1940s, there was this massive influx of East European Jews in the United States. The population increased from 250,000 in the 1880s up to about 4 million on the eve of the 1948 election. And as FDR in his last years was very ambivalent about the Jewish state because on his way back from Yalta, he met with the Saudi king Ibn Saud in Great Bitter Lake at the midpoint of the Suez Canal. And they were supposed to be talking about the post-war order and how the U.S. would have a sort of a security entente with the Saudis, how they would maintain order in the region. And FDR was struck by the virulence with which King Ibn Saud talked about Palestine. And FDR kept trying to shift him away from Palestine and back onto Saudi Arabia, back onto oil, back onto the Soviets, back onto security. And he kept hammering the point of Palestine. So by the time he died, FDR was fed up with the whole matter and was tilting back to the Arabs from some of the things he said. Truman comes in. Here was a guy who really truly believed that all politics are local. He was a Missouri County Commissioner. He was part of the big machine in Kansas City. And he really said, look, he was having big debates with his Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, and his Secretary of State, George Marshall, and they were saying, look, we need to look carefully at this whole Jewish state business because it's going to queer all our other strategic interests in the region, and we really need to think carefully about what we're doing. And Truman looks at him and he says, look, gentlemen, I've got 4 or 5 million Jews among my constituents and very few Arabs. You know, my mind is made up. And that is how he looked at it throughout. And he had a coterie of aides inside the White House, all of whom Jewish American aides like David Niles and Eddie Jacobson. These guys all said, look, it makes good political sense to back the Jewish state because we'll win the Jewish state inside the United States. And that was essentially the Truman policy. And of course, 1948, Dewey defeats Truman. Dewey had put a very strong pro-Israel plank into the Republican platform. And Harry Truman felt that he could do no less for the Democrats.
Since then, administration since Truman, that by and large has been the position of the American presidencies, the different administrations needing the votes of their Jewish constituency.
Well, that's what Quicksand does. And Quicksand was really a voyage of discovery for me. I was actually just going through the administrations, looking how each reacted to the problems posed by the State of Israel for U.S. foreign policy, seeing how they reacted. And each of them reacts in very utilitarian terms. One might even say cynical. I mean, they go for short-term tangible payoffs over long-term strategic ones. They feel they have no choice. To give you an example, the Kennedy administration, Kennedy had the Joseph Johnson plan of 1962, which had great hopes of success. It was a plan where the Israelis were going to resettle and compensate the Palestinian refugees, whose numbers, which are now up around nearly 5 million, were only at about 1.3 or 4 million at the time. So it was doable. Kennedy had also appointed, a very curious position, a White House desk officer for Israel, a guy by the name of Meyer Feldman. And Meyer Feldman said, you know, look, Mr. President, don't do this. It'll cause an eruption, a violent eruption in our relations with the state of Israel and also a violent eruption domestically. So Kennedy backs off the Joseph Johnson plan, which was sponsored by the Carnegie Endowment, and does nothing. And as you look through each successive administration, they all basically punt the ball on this one. And once AIPAC is formed in 1954, there's even more pressure placed on presidents and members of Congress to toe the line on this issue.
Go back then to the remark of Marshall to Truman saying that if we take this position with a Jewish state, it will give us difficulty with the Arabs in the Middle East. And that's been one of the contradictions throughout our experience in the Middle East, because with the Arabs, we have the oil interest. So develop a little of that idea on how we come to the oil and what kind of alliance that has brought to us.
We come to oil because, again, the transition to oil economies from coal economies and the discovery that the biggest reserves in the world are in the Middle East. And the British had been producing oil since the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, in places like Kuwait and Iran and Bahrain. And the U.S. came in the 1930s and started prospecting in Saudi Arabia. We were greeted by King Ibn Saud as being a even-handed, clean-handed government, unlike the filthy European powers who the Saudis saw as being exploitative and insulting. And so he really wanted to work with the U.S. Then, you know, as I say in the book, we went fishing for a cod and we caught a whale. I mean, the discoveries in Saudi Arabia dwarfed everything around them. The oil was cheap. It was easy to extract. It lay close to the surface. It came up with tremendous pressure. It was a real bonanza. As we became reliant upon this oil, Saudi Arabia became a prized asset. And what's interesting is that even though we started exploring and discovering and producing Saudi oil as early as the 1930s, we oiled World War II from American stocks. Middle Eastern wells were not even working because there was no way to get the oil out and ship it around because of U-boats and all the demands of the war. So World War II used up so much of the U.S. reserves that we realized, as Harold Ickes, the czar for petroleum, during and after the war, Harold Ickes said, you know, we can't oil another war out of North American stocks or even North and Central American stocks. We are going to have to use the Middle East. And he and Truman and then Eisenhower after him said, look, the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia in particular, let's just leave the oil there in the ground. That's our strategic reserve. By all means, we need to protect it. So that's how Saudi Arabia, a pretty indefensible kingdom, no natural defenses, tiny population, absolutely feckless army. No matter how much money and armaments we poured in there, the military was pretty inept.
It's also not a democratic state, an ally in the world for freedoms in the hearts and minds and the free world, so on.
Absolutely not. And there's a lot of reports from American officials, American officers on training missions over in Saudi Arabia, also British officials, because the Saudis had British and American advisors advising with the Navy, Army, and Air Force, all commenting on the various curiosities of the area. But what happened was the population was so small and so insignificant, it never really seemed like we needed to do anything to reform this country. And then as they became richer, we saw the backwardness and the corruption of the Saudi princes as being potentially helpful for us because we could manipulate them. As long as they were backward, corrupt, and unloved by their people, they would be entirely dependent on the United States for their protection, for their legitimacy. So we didn't really want a dynamic new regime. I mean, a lot of American officers who were in Saudi Arabia in the 1960s and 70s commented on this younger cohort of officers that were studying in the U.S. and absorbing American ways and American principles of government, and we're really thinking about coming home and launching a coup against the Saud regime, because it was better to have the Sauds completely reliant upon us.
Also true of our relations with Iraq and Iran and Egypt, we don't really want freedom-loving, vigorous, democratic republics.
I think we do now, but I think there was this period in the 50s and 60s and 70s when I agree with you, we really didn't. We thought that this was the best way to manage the region, to have these regimes completely dependent upon us. There's some differences between these countries. For example, Richard Nixon, because of the wind down after Vietnam and Vietnam syndrome and the war weariness in America and the apathy that was setting in and the counterculture and everything else, Nixon was looking for regional fence posts, strong, self-confident regimes. regimes that could buttress U.S. power and take some of the load off of an overstretched America. He actually went to Iran, he met the Shah, and he actually said to the Shah of Iran, protect me. He saw the Shah as being somebody who'd be strong enough to sort of hold up that end of the Middle East in American interests. There were differences here. There were times when the U.S. wanted strong governments, but at the same time, Nixon never applied serious pressure on the Shah to reform. It was clear that even as the Shah was arming, spending, 33% of Iranian GDP on the most advanced fighter jets, main battle tanks, destroyers, attack helicopters, spending Iran into ruin and causing social frictions in the country because the Shah's vaunted white revolution, where he was going to bring the country from the third world to the first world in a single generation, was breaking down because he was spending so much on armaments. Nixon still did not exert the kind of pressure that would have taken some of the money out of defense spending and put it into social improvements because, again, he wanted the Shah to be strong militarily, and he wasn't really interested in the Shah being that solidly rooted because then the Shah wouldn't be as reliant upon U.S. protection.
You talk about strains of idealism and strains of imperialism. You say from your book, America has persistently misread the intentions and motivations of every major player in the region because we've insisted on viewing them through the lens of our own culture, hopes, and fears. Can you maybe amplify that slightly?
A great example of that would be the freedom agenda of President George W. Bush, who came in and announced some very American-sounding goals for Middle Eastern countries. And then when they were partially applied in places like Egypt and the Gaza Strip, they resulted in the election of groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, because George W. Bush didn't grasp that if given the choice, some of these countries would vote for people that we didn't like. Remember he talked about how everybody wants freedom and freedom sort of one size fits all, but it's not. And I think when you think back during the Cold War, how we looked at the Middle East through the lens of the struggle between the free world and communism. But the countries in between, like Lebanon, and I have a chapter on the Lebanon crisis of 1958 and the Eisenhower Doctrine, which was invoked in order to protect Lebanon against Nasser and communism, it had almost nothing to do with communism. We sent the Marines in to save Lebanon from communism, but this was much more a faction fight between Lebanese Christians and Lebanese Muslims. Lebanese Muslims whipped up and supported by Jamal Nasser of Egypt, and the Lebanese Christians looking at, much like the Israelis today, looking at the demographic overhang of a fast multiplying Muslim population that was going to come to outnumber the Christian population, eventually overpower the Christian population. And instead of recognizing this and working with the different groups and trying to arrange a settlement that the Lebanese ultimately resolved for themselves, because remember, they had a good 20 years under this before they went to civil war, we chose to say, look, the Muslims are communists and the Christians are allies of the free world. And ultimately, the U.S. intervention really did not have that much of an impact and could have, the book argues, came very close to dragging us into a quagmire much like the Iraq War.
You say also that the point of the study of history is to avoid a dull uniformity and mischief in the unpitied calamity of being caught in the same snare. Are we in the same mischievous snare today in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Israel that we've been in, more or less, for the last 100 years?
I think not. I mean, I think that there's clear thinking going on. I think in Afghanistan today, very interesting debates happening inside the Obama administration about, obviously, the Joe Biden line that we should focus on counterterrorism and stop nation building and probably cut Karzai loose, as opposed to people like Secretary of Defense Gates, who are for a much more robust commitment and buildup. So you see some real debates going on, some fresh thinking. I think in Iraq, the tragedy of our effort in Iraq is, I mean, what did all those lives and treasure earn us in Iraq? I mean, we've got this country. I think Steve Cole said that best case is going to be like Colombia or Algeria, a state secure within its own borders, but unable to really flex its muscles as a regional power, and certainly not in U.S. interest because of its own internal conflicts.
Also, Iran has become the original power.
One of the things I noted is that the ironies is that Paul Wolfowitz comes to recognition of presidents back during the Carter administration when he's an official in the Defense Department, and he's going on and on about how we need to crack down on Saddam Hussein in the 1970s, because with the collapse of Iranian power after the fall of the Shah and the cutoff of money and spare parts and other aid to Iran, he feels that Iraq has become the peerless regional heavyweight. And then, of course, he comes in 20 30 years later, and he collapses Iraqi power and sets up Iran as the regional heavyweight. There's smart people looking at these things. You know, we're really not going to have any traction in the Middle East as long as we don't lean hard on Israel to get them out of the occupied territories, to get them to pull the settlements out, to get them out of East Jerusalem, to create a real Palestinian state that will be an earnest of America's even-handedness and true commitment to the region. And I think that I don't see any hope of this happening, frankly, because of the domestic political dynamics inside the United States today, and that's too bad.
So to sum it up is to make a clear distinction between the strategic interest and the political expedient.
Particularly in the case of the Israel-Palestinian imbroglio, that's the one that drives so much else in the Middle East. And I think advisors to presidents for the last 60 years have been talking about the need to think strategically and not short-term politically at home, and yet this makes very little headway with presidents, senators, or congresspersons.
So maybe the best that can be said is to survive and wait for better days. Thank you, Jeffrey Waro, for speaking with us today about the 100 years of America's adventure in the Middle East. I'm Louis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2010.